The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly guest Dharma series.
Being in the heart is about the willingness to connect with mystery. It is a willingness to connect with love, with the unified whole. The heart represents our own inner goodness, the most tender, compassionate, and caring side of us. It is our basic goodness, our true nature. This radiant, innate jewel represents what we aspire toward, as well as who we truly are. We already are this radiant being. It's all right here. We may feel far from it, but it is never far from you. The color of unconditional love is rose. And so if you choose, call in the color rose. Rose is the color, the vibration of it dissolves anything that separates us from that which is not love for ourselves and for the world. Allow that vibration of the color rose to just soften the body and the mind. Soften. Soften and allow the rose color to soften into the vibration of the color gold. Gold is essence, and our essence is love and light. Light connects to light. Like attracts like. What you feed grows. Consciousness expands. The nature of love is to expand. The nature of the heart is to expand until more and more of life shows up as light. Our essence is love, light. This essence is empty, and it allows everything to pass through. It is quiet and at rest. It is illuminating. It is peaceful and productive of bliss. When you have within yourself a deep insight into this, you realize that all you need is there in perfection and abundance, and nothing at all is wanting or lacking in you. So watch the unfolding of things arising, being there for a bit, and then passing away. Notice and allow everything to just pass through. There is nothing to push away, nothing to hang on to. Allow yourself to touch the deep stillness. Rest in the awareness of the truth of how things are right now.
inspired by the depth of her dedication to practice and also the honesty of her sharing. And she's been practicing for a long time. She's been meditating for 40 years and has been doing Vipassana, mindfulness practice like we do here, for 15, and has been on retreats in India and Thailand. And for the past 30 years, she's been a spiritual director and has done retreats and workshop-led workshops at the Dan Anderson Renewal Center at Hazleton. So I'm really excited to hear the parts of her story I have never heard.
Thank you, Spruce. Ollie, would you get the lights or somebody near the night lights, please? Thank you. Just have a little bit more light. Yeah, a little brighter. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. That's good, I think. Yeah, thanks. So it's really nice to see each of you, some of you whom I know and many of you whom I don't, but it's wonderful to see all your faces. And I am, first of all, aware of being in great awe and gratitude for all the people who have sat on the cushion in this place and on the bench for the first time. Because this is the first time I've sat here in this position. And it's been an interesting preparation and interesting to watch the variety of sensations and feelings that have arisen. And so there was some anxiousness and concern, you know, a little worry and all of that. And I've had the wonderful experience of having people be so reassuring. And it has put me in just great awareness and gratitude for the community. It's the we. And I'm very grateful. So, Odyssey of the Heart is the title. And I want to give some definitions to begin with. First of all, Odyssey. As you hear these descriptions, see if they resonate with your own experience, your own journey. So the first definition is, there are four. The first is, it's a long journey full of adventures. It's a series of experiences that give knowledge and understanding to someone. It's a long wandering or voyage, usually marked by many changes of fortune. So praise and blame, etc. It's an intellectual and spiritual wandering or quest. So now heart. In the practice, we use the term bodhicitta. Citta means mind. And it also means heart or attitude. Bodhi means awake or enlightened or completely open. Pema Chodron states, and I quote, "The completely open heart and mind of bodhicitta is called the soft spot, a place as vulnerable and tender as an open wound. It is equated in part with our ability to love. Even the cruelest people have this soft spot. Even the most vicious animals love their offspring." As her teacher put it, he said, "Everybody loves something, even if it's only tortillas." End quote. As I was reading some things of Pema Chodron, I was also struck with an experience that she described that happened to her when she was about 6 years old. And one day, she was walking by the house of an elderly woman who was just outside sitting in the sun, and Pema was in a particularly bad mood that day, as she describes it. And she was feeling lonely, unloved, and kind of mad, and just kicking anything she could find. And as Pema walked by, the woman saw and heard her, and she began to laugh. And here's what she said to Pema. She said, "Little girl, don't you go letting life harden your heart." And in her later years, Pema recalled this experience, and she recognized it as an essential bodhicitta teaching. In other words, don't let the mind states cover your true nature. Current example. 2 weeks ago, my computer, I don't know what you call it, picked up, got a virus. Never happened before. So I wasn't sure what it was. And of course, I didn't want it to be a virus, but it was. So I was without a computer for 9 days. A friend agreed to clear it for me. And 1 week ago today, I was to meet him at 8:30 in the morning to give him the computer. Now, that was great. Open mind, open heart. Before going to bed on Thursday evening, I read a few pages from The Wise Heart by Jack Kornfield. And in it, he describes his experience with Ajahn Chah's teachings about mind states. So I had read that, and I fell asleep easily, but I awakened at 3 a.m., and I couldn't go back to sleep. And so I wasn't restless, but I just could not get into sleep. Well, the next thing I knew, I awoke and it was 8:45. My alarm, apparently, I didn't hear. I fell asleep sometime, maybe around 6, I don't know. So I called my friend, apologized, and we agreed to meet at 8 a.m. the following Sunday, after which I was going to a conference that I was attending. So the point of all this is, what happened in my mind and body? Well, here's what happened. First thing I noticed was, oh no, aversion. I can't believe this happened. Denial. I'm jinxed. I don't sleep through my alarm. Don't do this. Judgment, more denial. Well, why didn't I set a second alarm just in case? You know, you should have remembered, Eileen, it's full moon, and you don't sleep well when it's full moon. So, more judgment. I really wanted my computer this morning. It's been 9 days, and now it's going to be 12. Wanting, frustration. This is really inconvenient. How am I going to get it charged? I'm going to be at this conference, and you know, I finally have it, and so now the battery's going to be dead by the time I get home. Well, again, aversion and awfulizing. Now, the point is, this happened in seconds. All of that went on in just literally seconds. And then my inner Ajahn Chah voice came in, and it was though this voice said, hey, darling, you know, how's your mind and body right now? And caught in some mind state again. And so I looked at that and I noticed, of course, there was all this mind chatter. My body was tight. My brow was furrowed, contracted. My body was contracted. Lower back ached. Tight mind, tight body. As the mind is, so is the body. Life is our teacher. Our culture teaches us to seek comfort. And one way to do this is to want to change, fix, or control what is going on in order to fit into our own desires and wants. And I like a sentence of Byron Katie where she says, when we argue with what is, we lose, but only 100% of the time. And so, in other words, you know, pay attention to the fact that controlling behaviors and wanting to fix and all this wanting simply doesn't work. It doesn't lead us to peace and happiness. Jack Kornfield, in every life, pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute keep showing up, no matter how hard we struggle to have only pleasure, gain, and praise. Buddhist psychology offers a different perspective, a different approach to happiness, teaching us that the states of consciousness are far more crucial than whatever the outer circumstances are. End quote. And there's a principle of Buddhist psychology that puts it this way. Recognize the mental states that fill consciousness. Shift from unhealthy states to healthy ones. A couple of years ago when I was on retreat, I was doing a loving kindness practice for most of the time. And I had an experience that opened my heart in a very surprising way. And it was sustained for some time. And when I talked about this with my teacher, his comment was, the heart opens and the heart closes. And that is how it is. We have times of being awake and clear and times of being dull and confused. The bodhicitta teaching reminds us that we have a choice, and it's we can either let the circumstances of our life harden us, you know, or as the woman reminded Pema Chodron, you know, little girl, don't let the things that are happening in your life harden your heart. That's one choice we have. Or, and with that comes being increasingly resentful and afraid, or we can let the experiences of life soften us and make us kinder and much more open to our fears and difficulties. So it's the openness and the warmth of the bodhicitta, the open, radiant mind and heart, that is our true nature and our condition. And this is the journey back home, indeed this odyssey of the heart. The classic book, The Little Prince, is often referenced when speaking or thinking about the heart. And the line is, it is only with the heart that one can see rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye. So literally, the heart is the eyes and the ears that know God. The heart is where understanding resides and is the origin of spiritual discernment. The heart has a different way of perceiving. In the West, the tendency is to see the heart as a or in a rather cliched and sentimental way. And it can easily be pitted against the mind so that we sometimes might say, you know, okay, she's in her head and connected to her thinking. Or he's in his heart if there's an orientation toward feeling. And many of us can think that the heart is the emotional center of our personal life. But wisdom tradition sees it very differently. In wisdom, the heart is primarily an organ of spiritual perception, which keeps us aligned with the realm of meaning, of value, and with what we truly know inside. It doesn't slice and dice things up. In other words, it's not about separation. It's non-dual, and it invites us to what Thich Nhat Hanh calls this place of interbeing or inter-are. So, to travel the inner and the outer terrain and its bumps is essential to this journey of the heart. Because the heart has the power to hold everything. Regret, loneliness, sadness, desire, frustration, happiness, shame, peace, anger, joy, all of it. And it's the place where we find a deep trust that wherever we are, whatever we need to face, that we can have freedom in the midst of it. Tara Brach says this. She says, perhaps the biggest tragedy in our lives is that freedom is possible, and yet we can pass our years trapped in the same old patterns. Entangled in the trance of unworthiness, we grow accustomed to caging ourselves in with self-judgment and anxiety, with restlessness and dissatisfaction. You know, for those of us in 12-step programs, it's that being restless, irritable, and discontented. Yeah. So, as is true for all of our old habit patterns, the conditioned behavioral patterns, they begin by being born into a particular family in a particular location. I grew up on a farm with two alcoholics, my father and grandfather, who lived with us until he died when I was age 13, so that was a long time to be living with two alcoholics, and my mother was the classic enabler. I was an only child for 8.5 years, and it's the perfect setup for being the responsible one, the one who takes care of everybody else, see some head shaking, and negates yourself. So I lived in constant fear of what would happen next. My coping mechanisms were to figure out how to do it right, be perfect, not rock the boat, and be the good little girl. All the while, I wondered, what in the world have I done wrong that all this is happening? So I searched for many ways to find my way out of this entanglement described in Tara Brach's words. I looked good on the outside, super responsible, capable, you know, all that goes with it, and a very nice person. I laugh at that all the time. On the inside, I was a mess, full of fear, anxiety, anger, hatred for self, and very practiced at keeping it all inside. Or so I thought. It leaked out in controlling behavior, people-pleasing, compliant behavior, approval-seeking, great judgment of self and others. Oh, yeah, and did I mention living life from the viewpoint of a victim? At that time, there wasn't a name for the web of emotional pain and unhealthy behaviors that I practiced. I mean, there may have been in the DSM, but that I'm not referring to that. I'm referring to something that could be helpful, and it was only later on in my 40s that that name appeared, and that name was adult child of an alcoholic. The term adult child of an alcoholic typically refers to adults who have grown up in alcoholic, addict, or other dysfunctional homes. An adult child is someone who responds to adult situations with self-doubt, self-blame, or a sense of being wrong or inferior, all learned in childhood. And without help, we unknowingly operate with ineffective thoughts and judgments learned in childhood. This regression can be pretty subtle, but it's there all the time, sabotaging our decisions, our relationships. And in summary, it means that we meet the demands of adult life with the survival techniques that we learned as children. Not good for relating skillfully in the world. So this gives you the context for this adventure, this series of experiences that brought knowledge and understanding, this long wandering voyage marked by many changes of fortune, pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, and this intellectual spiritual quest, this odyssey of the heart. So as a young adult, I used work and busyness to escape the pain and the difficulties I experienced. I grew up Roman Catholic, and during my senior year in college, the nudge to join a religious community appeared and would not go away. So I joined the Franciscan Sisters of Rochester, Minnesota, and though I couldn't verbalize it at the time, at some level of consciousness, I thought it would be a place of healing for me. I had this very idealized view of what it would be like. I could learn to meditate. I could study theology. I could be accepted, and everything would be fixed, and life would be good. There's only one problem. There was only one problem. The famous, wherever you go, there you are. I found the courage to talk to someone twice about the truth of how things were for me, but it fell on deaf ears because there simply wasn't the awareness at that time of how to respond to the impact of abusive situations. My life as a Franciscan sister spanned 30 years. It's a long time. The first 15 years were deepening, really, of all the conditioned patterns. Just deepening of them. So now, in addition to work as a way to hide and escape, I now had meditation to do that with. We can use anything. And so that was how I avoided still the pain and stayed entangled in this whole trance of unworthiness and trapped in self-judgment and anxiety. Both the work and meditation were ways of hiding. I was not in my body because it was never safe to be there. Some of you have heard the description before of the character in a James Joyce novel, Mr. Duffy, and the description is, Mr. Duffy lived a short distance from his body. It's one of my favorites, a lot of its favorites. And that's really a description of the addictive life also. Let me say that. The addictive life is a life lived elsewhere. That's it, period. We couldn't be in the present moment. It was too painful. If I had been able to be in my body, I would not have been able to push and drive myself so much. I would have noticed it. Stress and anxiety remained high. Despair followed. And the gift of the despair was that I finally knew that I couldn't live this way anymore. So what I've been describing is the first noble truth, the existence of suffering and stress. I taught for 10 years. That was the first thing I did as a Franciscan. And then I was in a parish job in a different position. And it was a job I liked very much. I loved the people. Everything was going well. And then we had a change of pastor of the parish. And that changed everything. Everything changes, right? Yeah, it does. So in a very short time, circumstances unfolded that allowed me to really see the unhealthy leadership in the parish. I left a parish, and then I took another job in a parish, and the same thing I noticed was happening. It would have been a repeat of the same pain that I had just gotten out of. And so with the support of my Franciscan community, I found the courage to say no to a male authority and resign before even beginning. Now, that was a very unusual thing to do in 1977. And it opened the door for a surprise sabbatical. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this next part because it was an important turning point in my life. And it's where I began to see the second noble truth, which describes the cause of suffering, grasping, aversion, and delusion. And the third noble truth, there is a way out. There is an end to the suffering, which happens when we can let go of our reactions, our fears, and our graspings. I was burned out, and I knew that I needed a very simple place of quiet, a place where I could really, really meditate, not hide in it, where I could work, where I could live with others. So I went to a place called Madonna House, located outside of Combermere, Canada. It's a little village about 180 miles northeast of Toronto. And it's a very simple place comprised of a main house, several other buildings, and there was also a farm about a mile and a half away, located on a beautiful river and in the foothills of the Laurentian Mountains. And so that period began the second half of my life as a Franciscan sister. And it was the introduction in my spiritual odyssey of Eastern influences in my life. In the beginning, it was the beginning, really, of a very slow softening and healing of the heart, mind, and body. Madonna House at that time was a community of about 40 lay men and women and several Roman Catholic priests. The director was a woman whose name was Catherine de Hewick, who grew up in Russia. And she really embodied such a living faith and a very earthy piety of the Russian people, along with bringing the great spiritual traditions and symbols of the Christian East. At age 15, she married a baron, Baron Boris de Hewick. And after the October Revolution of 1917, they lived through the terrors of communist persecution and the agonies of starvation and civil war. And finally, they escaped with only the clothes on their back, and they made their way to England and finally Canada. Catherine ended up in New York City for a time, and met Dorothy Day. Some of you may know her. We have the Dorothy Day House in St. Paul. So that is where she began, Catherine began to work with Dorothy Day and worked with the poor in Harlem and then went to Toronto and then Combermere. So there are lots of interesting things about Catherine, but I want to focus on what she and the community taught me about the principles similar to our Buddhist practice. The words were different, but the practices were the same. So first, Catherine introduced to the West the experience of pustinia. It's P-O-U-S-T-I-N-I-A. It's a Russian word, and it means desert. And it means it's a quiet, lonely place, a silent place, where one can go to gather courage to allow the truth to arise, to sit with the truth of how things are. No more hiding. It's a place to allow the inward noise and confusion to arise and to quiet down. The physical structure of the pustinia is very simple. It's a very, very tiny building. I call it a building, but it's one room, very small room. And inside is a simple cot, a very small desk and one chair, a wood stove, a basin and a pitcher of water for washing up. It's located in the woods, far away from everything. No running water, toilet, nothing. One has to face oneself, or options weren't very appealing. So Catherine believed that this place of silence should not be the exclusive prerogative of monasteries and convents. She believed that the simple prayerful silence is everybody's silence, and that it should belong to everyone who is in search of the truth. This is one thing she said. She said, "For where there is inward noise and confusion, there God is not." So in our practice here, we might say that the inward noise and confusion is when we are trapped in mind states which block how things really are. And in fact, to quote Catherine, she said, "Deserts, silence, solitude are not necessarily places, but they are states of mind and heart." So desert means more than a geographical place. The outer place can support the inner journey, and that's why we have now the beautiful Prairie Farm Retreat property as a way to support our practice. And so perhaps what we could say about true silence is that it's the heart and mind without the stories. In other words, emptiness. So to go into the pustinia meant entering into the emptying of oneself. Self will run riot. The Greek word for emptying is kenosis. And the verb form of that means to let go. Now we're familiar with that. Let go, surrender. It's to empty oneself. So it's to let go of clinging, attachment, greed, holding on to anything. It's the constant struggle with one's own imaginations, stories, plans, desires, and resistance. When we sit in with the truth of how things are, and emptying just naturally takes place, and all our plans and projects just fall away right before our eyes. They just disappear. The desert is like an altar on which moment by moment we bring the offering of our self-will, our wanting, and the many manifestations of greed, hatred, and delusion. Self-will, with all its manifestations, are what stand between each of us and our liberation. I stayed at Madonna House for 10 months, and during the first few months, Catherine gave me a bookmark. She gave it to everybody. And the words on it were her words that said, "Give me the heart of a child and the awesome courage to live that out as an adult." I used that as a mantra during the day, and that phrase still has great meaning for me, because it really does take a lot of courage to sit smack dab in the middle of our lives with an open heart of the child, the original light. It is that open light, that open heart, that keeps us aligned with the truth of how things are in this moment. So while I was at Madonna House, I had the privilege of spending 48 hours each month in the Pustinia. We took water, a small amount of bread, so it was a time of fasting and meditation. I did not know the word mindfulness then, nor was it used. But all that we did, I now see, it was all mindfulness and concentration practice. Again, the words were different, but the practice was the same. We all had assigned work, yogi jobs, although they weren't called that. And there were periods of meditation sprinkled throughout the day. I did various work while I was there, but most of the time I worked in the laundry. And I did laundry for 70 people with some help, not all by myself, but with for 70 people because there were lots of guests who came to visit who wanted to just be in silence and meditate and work, and similar to what we do in our retreats without not quite as much meditation time. But the laundry work was very calming, really calming. So I loved folding towels. It just was just so meditative for me. And it allowed a lot of unwinding of body and heart that happened there. So this was a beginning. The seeds were planted. So that part of my journey came to an end after 10 months, and I returned to my community in Rochester, Minnesota. And the remaining 14 years of my life as a Franciscan sister were spent doing retreat work of various kinds. I was trained as a spiritual director, and each year I committed to my own practice of 8-day retreats and longer periods, 30-day retreats, and had opportunities for several longer retreats. And I also was able to train in an acute care hospital as a chaplain for about almost 2 years with an internship. And I'm telling you all this because everything in my life has prepared me for the next thing. I mean, and I think that's true for all of us. Everything in our lives is a preparation that we have no idea of what the next thing is going to be. But all of it is. And so it was all preparation for 1984 when I began my work as a spiritual director and program director at the Renewal Center at Hazelden. Everything came together there. And during the years, all these years, I continued to meditate. I received a lot of help for the healing through other modalities, including therapy and a lot of body work. And lots of healing for these deeply ingrained, entrenched patterns. In 1989, I began to have questions about whether I was to remain a Franciscan. I had an excellent spiritual director, and after exploring the question, I came to the decision to take what is called a leave of absence from the community. And you start by a one-year period of time. And it's a time of discernment where you live by yourself and you disengage from community activities to see what is it like to live as a layperson. I had a job, so I got my first paycheck. And prior to that, the checks I got, I mean, I got paid. I was working at Hazelden, but they went directly to the community. And then I received a check from the community that was just enough to cover my rent where I lived with someone else, cover our rent and food, gas, and clothing. So the very first and most important part of this discernment process is to come to a place inside called holy indifference. And it means that you are not interested in the outcome. You know, we talk about you make your choice and you let go of the outcome. It's the absence of desire and aversion. It requires an open, non-attached heart. And in the words of T.S. Eliot, it's teach us to care and not to care. And still another way to describe this is to engage with the light instead of the stories that we make up. Very different. And believe me, in the beginning of this process, I made up a lot of stories, especially around money and security issues. The biggest block for me was fear, A lot of fear arose around financial issues. I had no savings, no retirement, no possessions, other than the clothes in my closet, some furniture, dishes, and a rented car from the community. As I said, I did have a job, which was no small thing. But I went future tripping, and I imagined myself as a bag lady wandering around Minneapolis. And maybe I had enough money to get a bus to St. Paul, you know, or whatever it might have been. And then I experienced some anger because I thought, you know, why now? Isn't it a little bit late to be, you know, considering this? You know, I'm 52, for God's sakes. And so I allowed all of this to arise. It passed, would come again, and pass again, until I reached the place of an open heart where it truly did not matter whether I stayed or left. Either one was okay. What mattered was that I enter the place of mystery, trusting that the clarity would come. And I knew that inner peace would follow, whatever it was, because being in alignment with the truth is what mattered. I had not yet begun Vipassana practice, but again, the principles are the same, no matter the language. So just as the capacity for self-reflection is key to Buddhist psychology, this was also essential for my discernment process. I needed to be aware of my mental states and notice the healthy and the unhealthy factors. In the Buddha's words, how does a practitioner remain established in observations of states of mind in the mind? The practitioner becomes aware when the mind is tense and when the mind is relaxed. The practitioner becomes aware when the mind contains hatred and when the mind contains love. The practitioner becomes aware when the mind contains worry and when the mind is peaceful. Another principle of Buddhist psychology applies to this part of my journey, and that is, our ideas of self are created by identification. The less we cling to ideas of self, the freer and happier we will be. I did not have the clarity I had hoped for by the end of 1 year, so I asked for a second year. And the more I let go of the identity of myself as a Franciscan sister, the more experiences of freedom came to me. And little by little, the direction became clear. Everything pointed to leaving. And even though that was clear, I still wanted very much something else, you know, like a sign, as though I didn't have enough, you know, just something for in the discernment process, you really want a confirmation. And I'd had things like that, but there was still something else I wanted. And I asked for it, and it came in a very unusual way, as these things do. I was learning healing touch at the time and healing work. And so I was at a healing practice workshop, and we took turns giving and receiving, and it was my turn to be on the table. And about midway through the work that someone was doing on me, my body, I began to have a sound come out of me. And it was, ooh, ooh, just like that. And then it turned into, ooh, ooh, and I felt like an owl, you know, ooh, ooh. And then it came, who am I? I want to cry with that because it was so powerful. And so, you know, that's the big question, isn't it? Not an intellectual answer. But, and the facilitator came over and she said, you know, just let yourself go inside into the silence and listen. And I thought, yeah, right, you know. Silence, you know, this is a really big question. Eventually, I was able to, and nothing came for a time. And as I settled in deeper into the quiet, some very surprising words came. They were not words that said, all right, my dear child, you can go. Wasn't like that. Here are the words that came. I don't want to wear black shoes anymore. I knew that was the confirmation. I absolutely do. I said, thank you. And I experienced just the deepest peace and inner freedom. Now, a little background for that. I came that day wearing a red t-shirt and blue jeans. And someone commented on the shirt. And it reminded me, I said, you know, I really like red. And I said, you know, I'm remembering I had this beautiful pair of red shoes when I graduated from eighth grade. And I said, I just love those red shoes. And then somebody said, well, you should get a pair. Now, that's before the healing. Afterwards, when this other experience happened, people reminded me of that. And they said, hey, red shoes, Dorothy, Wizard of Oz. Click your heels and you go home. And so it was like that, coming home. And so there's another Buddhist principle, psychology, that mindfulness of the body, really important, allows us to, doesn't say that. Skip the really important. Mindfulness of the body allows us to live fully. It brings healing, wisdom, and freedom. That is why there is such emphasis on be aware of your body. And when you first sit, it's be aware of the pressure points. You know, what are the sensations in the body? Come on home, be here. That's where healing and freedom come from. Now, healing and freedom did come, as well as sadness and grief for me, because I had no doubt, I would say, although I had no doubt that I had come to the right decision, it was still extremely difficult to leave a group of people that I loved very much and with whom I had so many growth experiences. Now, that was 23 years ago. In 1999 is when I began my formal Vipassana practice, and since then, it's been my main practice. And I have had the opportunity, as Spruce said, to practice in India and Thailand. They weren't specifically places that practice Vipassana, but it's what I did practice. And I just want to summarize the important things that I learned. So in 2002, I had the opportunity to spend a month in India at an ashram with Sathya Sai Baba. I don't know if any of you know that name. It doesn't really matter. But I would characterize that time as being about two things. Number one, it's the awareness that the mind has this great habit of making form important. You notice that? Yeah. And we want something to hang on to, something familiar. And Sai Baba had multiple ways of giving us opportunity to let go of form. And some of them were pretty funny. But it was just all kinds of ways. And so it's about, again, letting go, letting go. And the second thing is that Sai Baba used a phrase often, love your uncertainty. Love your uncertainty. And again, we had many, many opportunities to practice that. And it's to practice the I don't know mind. More letting go and surrender. At the end of one particularly difficult day, I was sitting in the back of the mandir. The mandir is this large meditation space where we would gather. It's very, very large. Marble floor, a roof, but open sides, no walls. And so at the end of this really difficult day, I was sitting in the back, and all of a sudden I felt these large areas of warm, wet, goopy stuff falling on me. It was on my head. And I opened my eyes, and it was coming down my arms, on my chest. It was going down the front and my lap. And I opened my eyes. It was pigeon poop. Yes, pigeon poop. It was the end. It was the perfect ending to a perfect day. My hair, my clean Punjabi, and I made some kind of a sound apparently. And an Indian woman came up to me and she whispered in my ear. She said, Oh, she said, that is such a great blessing. And I thought, right, you know, that's your perception. But who knows? For them, it really, somehow it did. I never found out what it was, and I didn't really care at that point. But again, it's just, you know, experience after experience. So two opportunities in Thailand came my way in 2003, and then again at the end of 2006 and beginning of 2007. And I practiced in a small village outside of Chiang Mai. Working with sound was very challenging there. There were lots of quiet times, but every Saturday night, the villagers had this great party at which they sang, and it was, it came out over loudspeakers, and I mean loudspeakers. Now, it was not chanting. It was karaoke in Thai. So, a lot of practice with sound and how do I meditate through this. Anyway, it works. So there was more unwinding of the knots, of the an undoing of the old ways of seeing, thinking, acting, and reacting. You know, it's like falling down and getting up, falling down and getting up. Lots of practices of compassion and equanimity. So in meditation, we let go of everything until we rest in the silence. And it's from this place that we're really able to see everything. You know, the radiance is always there. It's just that our attention goes somewhere else. So the invitation is to move from the heart, not from our stories. The heart finds its way, not through external conditioning, the stories, but through the presence of to what is, in what is called by the mystics the cave of the heart. The cave of the heart is where we come in contact with our direct knowingness. Preparation for this talk led me to see how my experiences have been threads of connection. And so some of those briefly are the farm, the land on which I was born, and grew up on, led to a really deep appreciation and connection to Mother Earth. Facing the impact of alcoholism on my life, committing to the necessary work, and how that led me to the past 30 years of work at the Hazelden Renewal Center. The attraction to St. Francis and the Franciscan sisters. Francis, who surrendered everything that separated him from truth. He lived in connection. Everyone and everything was sister and brother. Brother sun, sister moon, sister water, and so forth. Brother fire. It's like Thich Nhat Hanh, the inter-R, everything. We're all connected and related. The Postinia experience led to a reigniting of the hermitage tradition of Francis in our community. And when I came back, the president of our community had also gone to Madonna House. And so two hermitages were built on the grounds as a result of that, and very much a part of our tradition. And because of the retreat work that I did for the Franciscan community for quite some time, I came across a new retreat center that was being built around 1978 and 79. And I planned the first retreat there for some community members before the building was even completed. And we used tents. That place is a place some of you are familiar with, Holy Spirit Retreat Center. So that has a long history for me also. The sisters then were given the opportunity to purchase it for, I think, $1. And now, of course, they live there full time, and there are three hermitages, and Common Ground uses it for retreats. So it's a whole other thread. So this odyssey, this long journey full of adventures and experiences that give us knowledge and understanding, this long wandering voyage that's marked by many changes of fortune. Again, the praise, blame, gain, loss, pleasure, pain, the spiritual quest. All of these experiences give us a taste of the happiness and peace that come from following the path that the Fourth Noble Truth delineates. The practice of right understanding and right thought, right speech, action, and livelihood, right effort, mindfulness, and concentration. I close with a quote from Hermann Hesse. There is no reality except the one contained within us. That is why so many people live such an unreal life. They take the images outside them for reality and never allow the world within the body and mind to reveal itself. So let's pause for a moment, letting go of the words. May we be filled with loving kindness. May we be safe from inner and outer dangers. May we be well in body and mind. And especially remember and wish this for Gail and all those whom we know who are suffering in body and mind. May we learn to see the arising and passing of all things with equanimity and balance. May we be open, balanced, and peaceful. And may we recognize the radiant heart of the child within and have the courage to live it out as an adult. So there's time for questions or comments. If anyone wishes.
When you were practicing loving kindness, you said, what was the experience that said caused your heart to open?
It's very difficult to put words to that, and here's what I can tell you about it. It relates to what you heard about my story as an adult growing up with alcoholism present in the home. I found myself, I was using the kind of, you know, some of the phrases that we are familiar with for loving kindness. And I found myself shifting it to phrases like, may I love, may I accept and love all of my conditioned selves. Let me say that again. May I accept and love all of my conditioned selves. We have many of those. And so I just continued to say that phrase along with something like, may I accept and love myself as I am? Phrases like that. But this, the one in particular that I just said was extremely meaningful, and it shifted the energies in me. And that's about what I can tell you. There will be physical manifestations sometimes in our practice. You may have noticed, you may feel vibrations, heat, tingling, and so forth. And so that can happen with the heart area as well, where there is that, the sensations in the body that you know there is, it's this opening. It just, it's like it literally cracks open. That's the best way I can describe it. Does that help a bit? Okay. Yes.
Could you briefly describe Vipassana meditation?
Oh, okay. Well, the word itself is a Pali word, and it means to see clearly. And it's also called insight meditation for that reason, that it helps us to see something I've said a few times during the talk is to see the truth of how things are, so that we go beneath the stories we make up that are rooted in our fears and a lot of emotions that we may carry. Does that help you?
Well, all I've ever heard is that it's a breathing practice, so I don't quite understand how it relates to all this other stuff.
Well, and I think one would not understand that except for practicing for a while, perhaps. Does that, yeah. So well, I would encourage you, if you feel drawn to it, to come. There are classes that Mark teaches that are introductory classes. It's listed in the, there's a brochure out on the ledge. And if you're interested, that would be a place to begin. You're welcome. Yeah, Jean?
You didn't mention too much about sort of how you understood how you originally came to understand the effects of growing up with alcoholism in your household. And I'm wondering if you encountered like an adult children group while you were still a nun, or how that all worked out.
Okay, I began my own recovery journey in Al-Anon because of the situation. That was what was available. And that was very important for me in terms of seeing that the focus did not, focus had to shift from any blame or any of the, anything like that. It wasn't about blame. That the focus needed to be on me and my own healing. And so began in Al-Anon, and then the adult children's groups began, that whole movement started. And as soon as I was aware of that, that's then the group that I went to, and did have the opportunity to do weekends for my own healing for adult children groups.
So kind of in the middle of the time you were still.
Yes. It's a long period of time. Yeah, and so, yes, I did, well, in fact, the majority of that work during that time, the ending part of that period of time. Yeah. There was another hand, yes.
Yeah. Piggybacking on the previous Vipassana question, I was wondering, how does it differ from the meditation you were practicing years beforehand, and why did you personally decide to begin practicing Vipassana?
Okay. I practiced various kinds of meditation because of being a member of the community. There were many opportunities for a variety of practices that we were taught. And I spent quite a bit of time with what is called the spiritual exercises of Ignatius of Loyola. And that won't mean anything perhaps to most of you, but that's the name. And what it is, it's a series of written meditations. You read little sections and then go into quiet. It's a whole set of contemplations that you sit with. And it's all, every practice that I've done has the similar qualities would be that of letting go and surrendering to what is. And then I did centering prayer. A lot of people are familiar with that, perhaps. And that uses like a, kind of a mantra. Again, same, it takes you to a different place. But when I discovered Vipassana, the reason that I was, it felt like coming home, because it's so congruent with 12-step principles. I mean, it just is. And it, again, it's all about surrender and acceptance. And those are the two spiritual cornerstones of any 12-step program. Are those two principles. And it also is extremely, was and is very significant in terms of behavior and the habit patterns. There was nothing else that shone a light as brightly as the Vipassana practice does for me. Is that Mm-hmm. Emo?
Thank you so much for working so hard, bringing all this wisdom together, sharing a good personal story.
Oh, you're welcome.
What you said about Mr. Duffy, you know, the short distance from his family. I've heard that before, but I've never applied it to my own.
Ah. Okay. Yes. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Ah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. 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 Well, would you like to see a show of hands? Yeah, no, I think you're right. Yeah, I think that's fair to say it's true for all of us in whatever degrees or ways that we all face that in some way. Yeah, I think so. Oh, you're very welcome. Would anyone else like to comment on that? The trance of unworthiness is how she worded it. What that means, well, let me find the quote. She says, perhaps the biggest tragedy in our lives is that freedom is possible, yet we pass our years trapped in the same old patterns. And I think the old patterns, the habit patterns, is what's key here. Entangled in the trance of unworthiness, we grow accustomed to caging ourselves in with self-judgments, anxiety, restlessness, and dissatisfaction. So this trance of unworthiness is that we all, I think, pretty much to some degree have some experience of not liking ourselves very much. And it's moving, the healing is moving from that. Backing up. So out of that come these habit patterns, which are our ways of defending ourselves, kind of backward ways, but it's what we know. It's like we figure out, I think we're really creative as children in figuring out how to do this. But then as we come into adulthood, those things don't work. They help to survive, but they do not help us live in relationships in a very healthy way. A trance of unworthiness. Yes. Good questions. Yes.
So, I think in the beginning of your talk, you mentioned not letting hardships harden you, but letting them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, let me think. The experiences in my early life are what hardened me because I was in a whole defensive mode, protective mode. Let me use the word protection because that's really what it was about, is protecting myself. And protecting myself from more hurt. And actually, in that, I actually was creating more hurt. And I'm thinking of something that I think I put in. Yeah, I think here. There was something that I put here that I think relates to this. It's a quote from Ajahn Shanti. And he says, if you resist anger, you are always angry. And I did that. If you resist sadness, you are always sad. If you resist suffering, and that's the hardening, you are always suffering. If you resist confusion, you are always confused. We think that we resist certain states because they are there. But actually, they are there because we resist them.
Who said that?
Okay. His name is Adya, A-D-Y-A, Shanti, S-H-A-N-T-I. I got it from the Sounds True website one day. There was a little blurb on him, and that quote was there. Okay. Are there any other questions or comments? Yes.
You had spoken, I thought quite eloquently about community where you were in touch, and then you were come to what I thought was a very pivotal moment of asking the question of who you truly are.
Mm-hmm.
And in your thread of putting your life together, I think that my experience has been lived through true tenderness of that moment is when I have been able to arrive to an intimate moment within myself, that is the pivotal moment when I can like start living my life for me and not the external world.
Mm-hmm.
But what kind of has me stumble a little bit is that it's a scary place. I mean, like, I'm not 52, I'm a little bit different age, but you know, at such an adult age, it's hard to be in balance externally, internally, and going forward. I'm 46 years old, as a 46-year-old person out in the world, and discovering, I've done a lot of work with attachment, trying to understand that as well. But I mean, the true sense of the face of your true intimacy of who you are seems to be hard to nurture and develop that, because it seems to take such stillness to get there, to really grow that.
Mm-hmm.
How were you able to, out of your experiences, really pull that in and to really nurture that? Because I don't think we get a lot of enforcement or help with that. Because it's so private, it's so intimate. How did you latch onto that, or what did you use to help grow that for yourself?
Okay, so how did I help grow the love toward? Right.
You're born alone, you'll die alone, kind of thing. And now you're at that pivotal moment, but it's not easy to stay there and to nurture that piece to break through and to keep going. I was wondering what it's kind of being lost in the desert. And you're kind of like stumbling around by yourself.
Yeah, I'm trying to listen to the core of what you're asking. And I think that let me try some response here. I think of the Buddha's words here, hatred never ceases by hatred. It only ceases by love. And that relates, I think, to that, you know, the heart, don't harden, little girl, don't let these difficult things harden your heart. And it relates to the question you raised earlier also about the loving kindness practice, that there is the melting or the softening of all these hard places in me, at least, happened through a variety of ways and practices, including the healing touch work, including a lot of different body work. Because, you know, the issues are in our tissues. That's a phrase that we use often. Because there's nowhere else for them to go. And I can't emphasize enough the importance of the body, the awareness. And you mentioned that, Emil. It just, there's nowhere else for the fear, the anger, any of that to go except here. And it comes out in physical manifestations until we have the something that cracks us open to some practices that will support that healing. And it is the love. It's that loving kindness practice that I spoke about earlier, that, you know, just that phrase that came for me to, may I love and accept all of my conditioned selves. So I think the the overall umbrella is the different aspects of love. Like love has different flavors, like patience, perseverance, kindness, gentleness, you know. And so how do I bring that? So it's paying attention to how you treat yourself. You know, what do you hear yourself saying to yourself when nobody else is around? You know, does that at all get to what you were? Okay, thank you. So, anyone else? Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, the question is about holy indifference. And it doesn't mean that you don't care. It's like Tia said, you care, but you don't care. It's really letting go of attachment to either way. Whatever your question is, whatever, if there's a decision that you are making, whatever that is, that you let go of the outcome, that you have no investment in it going either way. That's a difficult place to come to. It took me a long time. And it usually means you face your fears and any other kinds of emotions that are attached to the question, the decision for yourself. Without that, there is no freedom to make the choice. Because then you'll do the same thing that you've always done, you know, is make the decisions out of head and skip the rest of yourself. You know, so it's that, there's neither any hanging on, clinging, attachment, or any aversion or pushing away. Does that, okay, yes. Yes, and oh yeah, right. A little conflict there. He said, "Yeah." Did you hear what he said? I'll repeat it. He said, "I hear all these motivational tapes that say, you know, you gotta want this. You really gotta want this." And then I come here and I hear you say, "You gotta let go of attachment." That's a dilemma. Yeah. So then we sit with that. That's what Mark said to me when I, by the way, Mark, if you do listen to this, thank you for inviting me to do this. It stretched me a lot. And what I said to him when he asked was, oh, I said, I mean, I'm already nervous and anxious and I feel really inadequate. And he just said, well, sit with that. So there you are. Okay, yes, Bruce? Yes, you were. I did mention that, you know, although the decision to leave that community was clear, that there also was a lot of sadness and grieving. It was like a divorce. And so there was grief. And then it was establishing other communities. And that's the key. Because we have more than one community in our life. We have different groups that we relate to. But to have, and my first other community was a group of 8 women who, with whom I was learning the healing practices while I was doing that. And we would practice together, and we have been together. We meet once a month. for 20 years. And so that was my first. And then Common Ground is a community, and you have other, you know, groups of friends. And, you know, and there's still, you know, that there still is the place of, you know, living alone. I mean, there isn't that one person, but that's how it is. Anyway, that's what I can say, I think, is primarily is to establish other communities. And my experience is that, I mean, you can feel alone in a group, you know, too. So it isn't always the external, although we need that. And that's my favorite, I think this is, yeah, my favorite spiritual paradox. We alone can do it, but we can't do it alone, whatever the it is. And so finding our way of being in the aloneness and what that is for us, and the movement from community to alone. And that's how it is, I think. Does anyone else want to comment on that? That there is that movement, no matter what our circumstances, of being alone with ourselves and being with this person? Or, I mean, I miss that. I mean, I won't say I don't. I miss that. Constancy, yeah, Kyoto. Yeah, yes. 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 Yeah, and that came up for me in Kyoto's Befriending Death class. You know, so, yeah, that interconnectedness in her R. Yeah, Jean. Mm-hmm. Yes, could you hear her? Okay, she was referring to Thomas Merton, who said that to go into solitude is the way that we most deeply connect to others. That, okay. And it seems like a paradox, which it is, but I find that to be true in my own experience. Yeah. Yes. One more. Uh-huh. Oh, okay. I mentioned that the being nice was a little unsettling, the way I said it. That was the word you used. And could I comment more on that? What is that like? Well, to be nice, I put it in quotation marks, because it's the external. It's the smile on the face. It's the always happy, you know, no matter what. Oh, yeah, you know. And it's the experience of being disconnected from myself. My niceness was like that, because I didn't know what I felt. I had no clue. I wasn't in my body. Somebody would say, how do you feel? Well, I'd tell them what I thought. It's all I knew. And made great efforts to always, well, like I said, don't rock the boat. Peace at any price. Be nice. Be good. But it was all external. Does that respond to your question or not? No? Oh, the Minnesota nice. Well, we have lots of labels, you know, and I don't know what it means, other than I know what it meant for me. Okay. Yes, thank you, Emil. Yeah. Some people say Minnesota nice, and it's really Minnesota passive aggressive. Yeah, that's a flavor of it. Yeah. Okay, so it's 8:45, so I think Unless there's one last question, I think we will bring to a close.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.